We are back. I am Paula Gordonville Russell, and I am with Dr. Jared Diamond in Los Angeles. I'm going to jump right to the middle, if I may. I am enthralled with your concept that the axes of the planet, the longitude and latitude, the east-west and the north-south, have a major story to tell us about who wins.
Well, and it's also impressive because I think most of us have come to think of geography as not terribly interesting.
It's something you have to get through in seventh grade.
That it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. And you're saying it not only matters, it matters a lot.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, listen, the motto is the motto of real estate agents, location, location, location. And it's true for human history. My experience, too, when I was growing up, geography consisted of memorizing the capitals of the states. And when I entered college in 1954, my college had just abolished its geography department. Geography has been in a downturn. But geography has been enormously important in human history. Let's just take the example that you mentioned. Picture a globe, picture the different continents, and then ask yourself, what is the most striking thing about the shapes of the continents? And one of the most striking things is that Eurasia is laid out from west to east, long way, 8,000 miles from the Atlantic to the Pacific, rather narrow from north to south. The Americas, in contrast, long way from Alaska to Patagonia, 8,000 miles, very narrow, from east to west, nowhere is more than 3,000 miles wide and only 40 miles wide at Panama. And then Africa, not as extreme as the Americas, but Africa is again long from north to south and narrower from east to west. And it turns out that had an enormous effect on human history. The effect was that plants and animals, while domestic plants and animals, can spread rapidly at the same latitude where there's no change of day length and climate and diseases.
Which is the east and west part.
And so plants and animals domesticated in China. China developed citrus fruits and chickens. Whoosh! They're in Rome and they're being eaten by Romans. The Fertile Crescent domesticated wheat and barley and horses. Whoosh! They're in China. Whereas here in the Americas, sunflower was domesticated in the southeast United States, never got south into Mexico. Llamas were domesticated in the Andes, potatoes in the Andes, never got north into Mexico. Mexico invented wheels, never trickled down into South America. So the one pack animal of the New World, the llama, never met the sole set of wheels in the New World in Mexico.
And that takes us back to your geography?
That's geography. That's because the New World is oriented north-south, and llamas and potatoes, which were adapted to the high, cool altiplano of the Andes, could not survive going across the hot, steaming isthmus of Darien and never got into Mexico.
I think one would assume that what that represents is a certain lack of diligence on the part of the locals. That it either didn't occur to them, or they did not choose to exercise the discipline necessary to domesticate plants, to domesticate animals.
That was a point that I was very concerned with in writing the book, and a large chunk of one chapter of the book consisted of six different arguments by which I finally convinced myself that it had nothing to do with diligence and everything to do with the starting material, the wild plants and animals. Example, modern European farmers and geneticists and animal breeders, they're very diligent, but they have not succeeded in domesticating a single really valuable plant and animal that was not domesticated 3,000 years ago. We've added...
Really?
Yeah, we've added a few trivial things. We've domesticated macadamia nut, big deal. We've tried to domesticate buffalo, but it's not been very successful. We've tried to domesticate moose, athalia, zebras, athalia. Essentially, every valuable plant and animal worth domesticating, wheat, barley, peas, rice, squash, horses, cows, sheep, goats, yaks, everything. It was all domesticated by about 2000 BC. The last valuable edition was the reindeer, 2000 BC. Okay, monks in the Middle Ages domesticated strawberries and rabbits. Big deal. That's nothing compared to the value of horses, sheep, goats, cows, pigs.
So
it's not diligence.
Those guys both were smart about what they were doing and had pretty well exploited that which there was to be exploited?
Yes, they exploited everything that was really valuable to be exploited. But
now, these are folks even before writing. I mean, they weren't passing around books on how to domesticate peas.
Correct. Most of this was before writing. A little followed writing. The earliest writing was about 3400 BC in the Fertile Crescent. And there were some significant additions thereafter. Apples. Fruit trees that require grafting. Now, grafting is really complicated. And the art of grafting did not develop until after the origins of writing, possibly first in China and then eventually in Europe. So the first evidence we have for grafting in Europe is in classical times. That's, what, 3,000
years? Paula said something that makes me a little nervous, that may be confusing. She said these people were smart about it.
Yes, and
I love being stopped.
And that sounds as if somebody, you know, a group of elders sat around one day and said, grain, good idea, let's do that. That's not the way it happened, is it?
Very good point. You are correct. Being smart has nothing to do with it. There's a debate among historians, and I think the lay public might naively assume, how did agriculture rise? Well, some hunter-gatherer said, this hard life, really, I've had enough of it. I don't want to go out and dig roots. Look at those peas out there. If we just brought them home and watered them and grew them, we wouldn't have to struggle around in the forest. Well, it didn't develop that way. Agriculture developed unconsciously. It developed as a result of hunter-gatherers going out and gathering this stuff, bringing it home. Some spilled in their garbage heaps. It sprouted up. Bulb, idea, more sprouted up, and eventually
some came out of the latrines. You say that in the book too.
Yep.
That after they ate it, just like the birds, that the seeds would have a very fertile place to grow.
That's right. It's not just that the seeds. It's not just that wheat grains and peas spilled over into their garbage heaps. It's that things that we eat and that pass through you, seeds come out the other end of many plants ready to germinate. In fact, many plants will not germinate unless an animal or a human eats it and passes it through your intestine, so that our toilets were as important as our garbage heaps in the origins of plant and animal domestication.
So there was a feedback loop. You know, they would bring in seeds as an example to eat. Some of them would spill. They would grow. Since they're available, you would use them again. And sort of close the loop, and as you used them more and more, presumably the plants that you picked would become more appealing to me as a consumer.
Exactly. It is a feedback loop. You go out there, here are all these wild peas. So you pick the bigger peas, not the little peas, and also you pick the peas whose pods have not exploded, scattering the peas over the ground. So you bring back those peas and they fall in your garbage heap. What then grows up in your garbage heap is big peas and peas with non-popping pods. Instead of all the small peas and popping pod peas out there, the result is that unconsciously you have made peas more useful to humans.
Naturally selected them, didn't you?
The term that is used is artificial selection. And in fact, Darwin's book, Origin of Species, it's about natural selection. But the first chapter of Darwin's book is not about natural selection. It's about farmers and artificial selection because it's such a clear example of selection.
Yeah,
unconscious.
I sometimes think that distinction between artificial and natural, I mean, we think of anything that humans intervene in, even unconsciously, as artificial and everything else is natural. The problem, of course, is that tends to separate us out from nature and make
us
think that we're something special, which also goes to your representation of the third chimpanzee.
I was going to say, this is also the author of The Third Chimpanzee, which many people find quite alluring in thinking about humans as part of the great ape family and not distinguishing ourselves in the same way that we have always done.
Genetically, we're not distinguishable from the great apes. 98.4% of my genes and your genes and all our listeners' genes are shared with the genes of chimpanzees and gorillas.
Now, this is not the human temperature. This is how much different we are. 98.4.
Correct. This is not 97.6 degrees Fahrenheit temperature, but 98.4. 98.4% genetic identity with chimps and gorillas. And in fact, there's an argument still going on. Are we genetically more similar to chimps, or are chimps genetically more similar to gorillas, or are gorillas genetically more similar to us? It looks now as if we and chimps are 98.4% similar, and chimps and gorillas might be 98.2, and we and gorillas 98.1, but it's really close.
That's very similar, which brings us back to the not being very separate from the rest of the natural order.
So the difference between artificial and natural is 1.6%.
You could put it that way. Alternatively, you can say that artificial selection is domestication produced by humans, and natural selection includes domestication produced by plants. For example, squirrels running around with acorns, or robins running around with strawberries and cherries and other edible fruits. Robins are modifying many wild fruit trees to be more useful to robins, and squirrels are modifying oak trees to be more useful to squirrels, and we have modified macadamia nuts and wheat to be more useful to us.
So if you're a squirrel, squirrels have domesticated oak trees in some sense. And in fact, that's part of the reason we haven't been able to domesticate oak trees.
That's right. If you asked, if squirrels could speak and you asked squirrels, they would say, we squirrels domesticated oak trees, great example of artificial selection. Some of those other rubbish animals out there like humans, unconsciously, without any intelligence, domesticated strawberries, but that was an unconscious, unconscious reflex act, and we squirrels are the ones who sat down and said life is lousy.
Squirrels, also known as the people.
The people. Well, I've heard, a friend of mine once said, who is the father of a screech owl, said, now you do know that screech owls have the screech owl god. It is sort of the same line of thinking, that if one is species-centric, one sees the world and the natural order quite differently, yes?
Yes.
Isn't that part of what you're telling me in this, how we covered the planet?
Yeah, I'll give you another example. Yesterday, I published an article on ant agriculture. There are ants related to leafcutter ants, which practice agriculture. That's to say, they bring home mushrooms, they grow the mushrooms in their nest, they add fertilizer, they weed the mushrooms, they add herbicides, and eventually they eat the mushrooms. And there are nearly 200 species of ants that practice ant agriculture.
Remarkable. This is Dr. Jared Diamond. We have a great deal more to talk about. We're going to do that when we come back. We are with Dr. Diamond in Los Angeles, Bill Russell and I. There's lots more.